Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk. I'm Laura Mize, speech language pathologist.
And I'm Kate Hensler, squeaky tonight because I had laryngitis for 4 days, but this is good, so trust me when I say I'm glad it wasn't yesterday or the day before. Anyway, I'm a developmental interventionist with the First Steps program in Louisville, Kentucky.
I'm so glad you were able to make the show. I kind of had a little bit of a panic when I read your email and thought, oh, no, I can't believe she's still going to do it if she's still so sick. So thank you for rallying and being a real trooper tonight.
I'm not that sick. I just have my normal voice thing. So this is really good. I know I'm a little squeaky, but I guess it was Friday that it was terrible. So I'm on the rebound. It's just not 100% yet. So no big deal. Glad I could do
All
it.
All right. Well, good. I'm glad too. Okay, give us the update on the Dream House. Give us the countdown. It's soon, isn't it?
It's getting really close. Well, the official date is supposed to be Friday, which I don't really think is going to happen, but I'm kind of thinking it could happen in a week after that. So, so we're really, really close. This was a huge week. The appliances are going in. They're finishing the plumbing. They're finishing the electrical. Laura, I know you know, but I'll share with our listeners. We had our elk antler light installed on Friday. Was it Friday? I guess it was, Friday. And that was, I've joked, but it's kind of true. This whole house has always been centered around this antler light that for some reason, I don't know, because nobody in my family hunts or anything, but I just love them. And so I decided that this house had to have that. And there's kind of a lodge room with a big fireplace, and that's kind of the earthy, cozy room. And I just always envisioned this antler light. So now the antler light is there. And so it's all coming together. I'm thinking two weeks. Possibly.
I can't wait to see it. I hope by the end of the week I can scoot in there and see it.
Well,
so
wait
till after the day,
because that's when we get appliances, and that's going to be huge, too.
Yeah. I'm going to wait till the end of the week, and Macy's on spring break this week, so that'll be a lot of fun. Okay. Well,
okay.
I'm glad we've had the update for that. I'm going to move along with these other little updates because we have a caller tonight, and she is already on hold, and I bet she's getting antsy with us just doing our normal small talk. But let me get through my little introduction housekeeping things, and then we'll roll right into her questions. First of all, my upcoming dates for my conference, Early Speech Language Development, Taking Theory to the Floor. I'll be in Macon, Georgia on May 5th, Atlanta on May 6th, then my Tennessee tour, Chattanooga on May 18th, Knoxville on May 19th, and Nashville on May 20th. We do have an upcoming date, too, in May in West Virginia, but the location has been really, really difficult to firm up. So hopefully that'll be on the website this next week, and I got a couple of emails about that at the end of the week. Yes, I'm coming to West Virginia, but I don't know where or exactly when, other than sometime in May. Second thing, if you still want to take advantage of the coupon code for the new book, you can email me at laura@teachmetotalk.com and just put in the subject section new book, so that when the book is released that week or two before it officially goes on sale on the website, you'll get a chance for a special discount, and that's only for people who are on the mailing list. So get your name in if you haven't regularly communicated with me and don't regularly get things from me. That being said, the other way to really get more up-to-date information is by, excuse me, now my voice is going out, by being a friend of TeachMeToTalk.com on Facebook. And a lot of times if there's a link that I really like, and if I don't have time to do a post about it on the website because that takes more effort and it's a more complicated process, I'll just link it on Facebook. And I have been loving the interaction that I've gotten with therapists and moms on there too. So look TeachMeToTalk.com up on Facebook, and you can easily find that site from going to the real website at TeachMeToTalk.com and then looking down in the right-hand bottom corner and clicking there. So do that. Let's see. I wanted to mention the Skype consultations have been so much fun. I have so loved getting to talk to people almost face-to-face using Skype with the computer, and that's been a ton of fun. And I've gotten to Skype with some people that I had just previously emailed before, so it was so exciting to put a face with a name and kind of a tone that a mom has had in an email. That's been a lot of fun. So if you have really specific questions about your child and want more in-depth analysis or a second opinion or any other just, how can I say, just a better way to communicate, that Skype service is there, so you can look up details about that on the website at teachmetotalk.com. And then I did want to mention that Johnny tried to convince Kate and me this week that we should try out for Amazing Race. I don't know how many of our listeners watch that show on CBS on Sunday nights, but now that our podcast is on Sunday nights, I kind of associate Sunday nights with you and with Amazing Race, so that would have been funny if we had gotten on that show. I don't know if anybody's snickering besides me, you, and Johnny, Kate, but I thought that I would mention that.
I feel like I've been living the Amazing Race with this house project of mine, and you can hear it's about ready to kill me, so I don't know that I would have been the best candidate, but it would have been fun one way or another.
I don't know if we could have bungee jumped and eaten weird food and traveled and been mauled on the bus and in India or whatever. I don't know if we could have done that, but it it's made Johnny laugh just even thinking about it. So
even the idea of us trying would be entertaining for him. Yeah,
yeah.
My husband probably would have put it the same way. Yeah.
A continuation of our comedy routine. So anyway, all right, let's move on. We have such a great caller tonight. Carrie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Carrie is a speech pathologist.
Hi.
Carrie is a speech pathologist who's emailed and corresponded with me over the last couple of weeks and had such great questions about working with late-talking toddlers and about just kind of this general approach and philosophy that Kate and I talk about every week here on the podcast and that I've written about on the website and that I filmed in the DVDs. And, Carrie, you have one DVD, don't you? You have the Apraxia DVD.
Right, that's the one I got. Uh-huh.
Right, yeah. And you watch that, and you're pretty new to early intervention, right?
Right, yeah.
Working with babies and toddlers.
Mm-hmm.
And so after watching that, you were just kind of comparing what's going on with your late toddlers versus the stuff that you hear in the podcasts and versus the DVD and kind of thinking, how do I make all this work? And so you had some really awesome questions about when to use some of those specific techniques and how this playful, high energy, say it approach might be more beneficial for some children when it's not beneficial, what guidelines you use to decide who this might work best with. And I just thought your questions were great, so I'm so glad you agreed to be on and ask us these kinds of things in person. So if you want to give us a little bit of your background to start, that would be super, or you can just jump right in with your questions. It doesn't matter to me.
Okay, well, I'm a speech-language pathologist, and I work in Virginia, but most of my career I've been working in the schools, and so the kids have been a little bit older, but we do have some preschool programs in our county, so I have worked with some little ones, but it's been in a sort of a different setting, usually in the classroom, that type of thing. But then a couple of years ago I started doing early intervention, and I'm finishing my second year doing early intervention work in the homes with the babies and the moms there.
Right.
And sometimes
it is a different setting. Yeah, it's completely different from a classroom environment or from an environment where you did maybe pull-out therapy with your older elementary-aged kids. It's a totally different thing, and I think it's sometimes unnerving for lots of therapists who've been in more of a clinical environment or an office setting because you feel like I'm on somebody else's turf here, and I'm not quite in control of what's going on and what's okay to do and what's not okay to do. So I think a lot of people will struggle with that their first couple of years. Was that your experience too?
Yeah, and I think for me, sorry, I have a lot of kids.
It's okay. There's always a lot going on at
people.
My house. So,
I think for me, one of the biggest issues that I had was I think naturally I can relate well with very small children, and so that was not a problem. But then when I watched your video and I saw how you were doing it, I was like, oh, wow, I'm doing it really differently. I'm really calm. I'm really, you know, sort of nurturing, you know, and I'm not making the kids say anything. And
yeah.
I thought, whoa, I need to really step it up and do it
yeah.
differently, because I'm not getting as much out of the hour as I could be.
Right. And I think that's the backbone of the whole approach, is making the most of that hour and making the most of that time, because I have seen lots of therapists who use a more laid-back approach and who use more of the observe, wait, and listen model, and or who, you know, just kind of narrate what they're doing. And while that's fine and those are perfectly acceptable approaches, you're just not always as efficient as you can be, and maybe don't move kids along as quickly as you could if you took a little more, and I've started calling it a pleasantly pushy approach, where you're still fun, and you're still, and I still think of myself as nurturing, even in the context of, you know, say it and do it. I just don't, I just still think of myself as nurturing. I don't see that how this approach could be classified as non-nurturing, because it's not really say it or else, because I don't think say it or else really works. You know, I don't think you can really lord over a kid and say, you know, you have to say milk or you don't get this sippy cup. You know, I would never, ever, ever advocate for that or recommend that or anything like that. And I think that were the rules for withholding carry in the apraxia DVD? Do you remember that section?
I don't remember if it went into that kind of detail.
Yeah, I think rules for withholding are in the first DVD, Teach Me to Talk. Okay. And so the apraxia DVD is kind of stepped up from the more introductory, Teach Me to Talk, just with the very basics, with being playful and modeling and teaching signs, and then moving on to expansion, and withholding is a section on there. So I think that you might have seen, again, kind of the stepped up, more advanced, this is what you do if the other basic stuff doesn't work. And so you might have a little bit of skew as far as what I really might do first versus what you do with kids who really kind of need that extra push to get it going. Do you see what I'm saying by that?
So you're saying that when you start with a new kiddo, you wouldn't necessarily start right off the very first session with say ball, and
yeah.
That would maybe show them how fun it is to play with the ball.
Sure, and it just depends on where a kid is in the process, where a kid kind of is in his development. Now, I have had kids that I've started off with that right away. If I know that I'm the replacement therapist and the other therapist hasn't gotten too much out of them, or if I get there and they're kind of a real high-energy kid and they start kind of popping out words before I'm even eliciting those, or if I go in and they already have, say, they're 2.5 and they have 10 or 15 words already, and I think, oh, boy, you have just been waiting on me, then I might start with withholding, which is what most of your questions are about, right off the bat. But usually you're going to kind of know what kids can handle that and what kids can't handle that. It's not always an age thing, because I think one of the questions that you asked was, is there a difference between how you treat a kid under 2 versus how you treat a kid over 2? And really that would be kind of a developmental level that you would look at versus a real age level. Do you see what I mean by that?
Yeah, and since I've been trying to do this more, I've discovered that some kids don't seem to know what I'm asking them to do.
Right.
Some of the younger ones that aren't 2 yet. Like I'll say, you know, I'll try to use some of the language from the video. Tell me what's, tell me with your words, or tell me with your mouth.
Yeah.
To say it like, you know, I'll try to say it like you did. And they just, one little boy just like touched his mouth. Like, what do you want me to do?
I understood mouth, but I didn't get that other part.
Yeah, what do you want me to do with this?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and that's pretty common. And again, I think the specific things that you are thinking about and talking about are for children that I really knew needed that extra push to be able to do any kind of verbal word versus just every single kid on your caseload. And I'm not saying that I don't eventually get there with most of the kids, but at the beginning I might not start out with, especially if it's a younger kid or developmentally younger, like they aren't following all kinds of directions. They don't necessarily have good social referencing, whereas if I tell them to, you know, say it with your mouth and they only get the mouth part and then they're kind of fixated visually on my mouth. Have you had kids like that?
Yeah.
They're radar locked on. You're telling them you're holding any kind of toy, Elmo, the ball, whatever, and you're saying, you have to tell me, and they can't even take their eyes off the toy to be able to look at me. They still don't have joint attention. And so they're not going to respond to those kinds of cues yet because they're developmentally not ready for those cues.
Okay.
So you have to look for those developmental signs and follow the rules for withholding. So we're going to talk about what those rules are and when you do and you don't use withholding. Kate, you want to jump in with anything before we get going with that? Do you want to talk about what you do or how your take on this so far?
Yes, I'm going to say this. In Kentucky now, some number of years ago, we evaluated kids ourselves. They would come in and get a general evaluation, and then as each discipline was recommended, we would do our own evals. And so from the get-go, I felt like I had a pretty good idea how a child was doing, kind of in general terms anyway, you know, in all areas of development. Nowadays, we have one person who goes in and does a general assessment, and we kind of hit the ground running based on what that individual primary level evaluator tells us or what her report tells us. And so I definitely, when I get started, first I read their report to get some idea so that I have some clue where a child is functioning. And I'm going to take things in based on what she says and what she's determined as far as what, you know, what she thinks the level of development is. And then
Kate, by that you mean if a kid is still developmentally or cognitively way lower than his chronological age, say that you get a kid who's 24 months and he's functioning in that, you know, right at that 12-month level, that determines what kind of toys you're going to take in for him. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
I'm going to know if I see based on the primary level assessment that his receptive language skills are very delayed, say 12 months, 12 to 15 months, 9 to 12 months, whatever it might be, I'm going to know, well, I'm going to take in fun but really, really basic kind of functional play toys, you know, my ball toy with the hammer and my, you know, maybe a simple little car toy, or so it's got to have a lot of bang for the buck. You know, it's got to be something that has a lot of action, it's simple, not particularly language-based, really. You know, is that a kid I'm going to do puzzles with initially? No. Is that a kid I'm going to even think of a book? No. Is that a kid that I'm going to take anything that requires any kind of even simple pretend play? No. I would probably take my Cookie Monster because I can get about 99.9% of all children on that one. But, so, yeah, I'm going to know going in, these are the things I suspect this child's going to like. And typically, at least after practicing that a long time, it's pretty easy. And parents are, you know, always funny about saying, well, I can't believe he loves that. He doesn't really play with anything. And, you know, a lot of times that's kind of based on what they may have and not really knowing how to decide themselves what their child might like. But anyway, So if I know a child is that low, that's not a child that I'm going to push too hard on trying to get him to verbalize for really anything. Because
he's not ready. Because he's not
ready.
Developmentally ready yet. Right.
Right. So
I would say that the kids that I see just right now, I mean, I don't have the vast years of experience that you guys have, but just so far,
right.
The ones they tend to give me, maybe they're putting those kids with the developmental interventionist also, the cognitive.
Right.
I get more
right.
the, oh, he understands everything, but he doesn't say anything. So
yeah.
I get that a lot.
And do you think that when you start looking at them, Carrie, do they really understand everything, or is that just the verbal report you're getting from moms?
That's the verbal report I'm getting from moms a lot. I get that a lot, and I do wonder to myself, do they really understand everything? And also, but we also use the early learning assessment profile, which I guess
right.
is okay. But, you know, so it'll show on there receptive language is. But when you look at the receptive language test or, you know, what they had to do to get that normal rating, it's not that many things.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Do you
it's
guys
like,
get to do? Yeah. I know
it's
exactly
three
what
things.
You mean.
You know,
yeah.
And it's based on mom's report, so some of it.
And most moms, no matter, unless their children are significantly behind, are going to always say they understand, even when they don't. So that's one thing that I would suggest, is that you go ahead, even though you're not technically paid to do this or required or even encouraged, is to do a more in-depth look at that receptive language on your first session, because
okay.
that's going to let you know right away. And receptive language is so near and dear to my heart. I mean, I just think that is so... Receptive language delays are so overlooked. And so when you go in and start to really, again, kind of push a kid to talk without really knowing that receptively he understands words, you know, he has to understand them before he uses them. And so I think to take a mom's word for it, or in my opinion, even another professional's word for it, you know, sometimes then we waste time in therapy working on expressive things that they are nowhere near ready to do, because they do not have enough of a receptive language foundation to really even be targeting expressive language yet. And so if I were you, I would look at a different tool
okay.
to give you some more information, even if you're just using it kind of as a quasi-assessment, or as you're like saying to mom, how many body parts can he do when you ask? And sometimes moms will say, oh, he knows body parts. And then you'll say, okay, great, show me your teeth. Show me your hair. Where's your nose? And a kid can do none of that.
Mm-hmm.
And a mom doesn't even really understand what you're talking about. She might say, well, I bought a new arm because when I'm holding his shirt and say, put your arm in, he does it. And she's not really realizing that her child is maybe over-relying on visual cues to even get through his day. Or you might ask her some of those other questions, like what kinds of commands does he follow? And she might say, well, he understands everything, but he doesn't do anything I say. And that makes me think, well, then does he really understand anything that you're saying, too? If you can't, and Kate and I say this all the time, until we see a kid do it, we don't really believe them, do we, Kate?
No, not, certainly not 100%. And what you described really about parents saying, my child understands everything, he just doesn't say anything, is really the rule, not the exception. And often, honestly, here's my honest thing about that. If I get a kid who really does understand everything and doesn't talk, as the parents says, the vast majority of the time, I'm pretty surprised. Are they out there? They certainly are. But more often than not, and what you find is when you really start to investigate and probe into, okay, what does he really understand? He understands, get your shoes, it's time to go bye-bye and throw this away. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, not too much. You know, they may be reading the cues that the parents are giving them, which is great. I mean, they need to give them because the child needs to understand. But, you know, they respond, they get the ball only because mom's pointing to the ball and saying, get the ball, get the ball, get the ball. But without the gestural cue, the kid really doesn't know what mom is saying. And parent, that's a hard thing to kind of separate out, I think, at least for me sometimes, well, what does he really understand? And parents don't necessarily have the knowledge or the instinct or whatever to really get that. So, you know, I hope it's true, but a lot of times it isn't. You know, there's a lot of gray area in between. My child can get his shoes and throw this away, or go get your cup, and they do it. You know, they only understand those things that they've heard so many, 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 many times. And then there's all this other stuff that they should be responding to or able to understand, and they really don't. So I had it happen last week. A new kid, I started to ask mom, well, does he do body parts? Yes, he knows body parts. And I had seen him, this was my second session, and I was already thinking, I'm not so sure this kid could probably point to body parts. But I said, oh, good. Well, which ones can he do? And she went on to tell me that she does this little song that she's made up. She points to her eyes and sings it in her nose and blah, blah, blah. And I said, so if you say, where's your eye? Does he point to his eye? Well, no. Well, if you say, where's your nose? Where's your ears? No. Does he do any of that? No. Well, he can kind of go along with the song when she does it. That's what she...
But then the parents saying something like, he's tired, or he just doesn't want to do it, or, you know, make you kind of telling you why.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I'm not argumentative when a parent's saying those kinds of things. I say, oh, gosh, I understand. But until I can see him do these things and until he can demonstrate that he understands language, he's not ready to talk. And that would be like, and I give examples and say, that would be like me saying because he wears shoes that he also should be able to tie his shoes. And, you know, giving them analogies like that with how important receptive language is, that they have to understand words and follow a lot of directions pretty darn consistently before they're really able to link meaning. And until they're linking meaning, they are nowhere ready to talk. And so you have to help parents understand how important receptive language is. And you have to say, you know, I understand that he might be tired today, or he might be getting a little sick, and we're all apt to do less than our best when we're at that level. However, we've got to teach him to understand language and to follow our directions no matter really what's going on, because when we, again, use those excuses and week after week after week after week after week think that, oh, gosh, he just doesn't want to do it, you know, why are we even there then? You know, what's our purpose if we're just going to kind of sit it out and blah, 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 blah. And that's why I think using a higher energy, really playful, over-the-top animated approach takes care of lots of those kids that are kind of that low arousal that parents think that they're really disinterested or they're bored or whatever. You can go in with a really playful, fun approach, and even if a kid is feeling a little bad or is, again, takes a little bit more to get his motor going, that approach works with those kids so that they kind of overcome those things that their parents say are their challenges or their reasons for not wanting to play or participate. So that's the number one reason that I think that a really playful, over-the-top approach works for nearly every kid, no matter what you're working on.
Do you have
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Did you have a tool that you said you might want to go in and use another tool to test out that receptive language? Or do you have one that you use your favorite? Or
The Rossetti Infant Toddler Language Scale.
Okay.
And you can get that, I think it's a Lingua Systems product, so you can order it online at linguasystems.com. If not, just search it. It's the Rossetti. And it's the most widely used scale for measuring infant toddler language development from birth to three in the United States and around the world. And I like that because it's a checklist kind of thing. It's not like the preschool language scale 4 where you have to, it's standardized and you get to score it and all that stuff. The Rossetti will give you a nice, pretty comprehensive look. Yeah, Johnny just looked it up in his Lingua Systems at a kid's receptive language scores. And those are the things, Carrie, that I would talk to a parent. I would say, you know, you had the, you know, we've done the assessment that Virginia requires us to do, but we're going to use a look, take a little more comprehensive look, because I want you to understand exactly why your kid's not talking yet. And if you start to make those correlations between he's not ready to talk because he doesn't understand language, it'll be more obvious to parents. And it'll tell you, too, what you need to work on. Because if you have a kid that's developmentally, his receptive language is down at the 9 to 12-month level, he's not ready to talk yet. He doesn't understand enough words. So you've got to build that receptive language base so that you get him to the point where he is ready to really start to be able to imitate. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Totally, yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Let's back up and talk, or I guess back up is not right, move on and say that we do have a kid where his receptive language is pretty close to typical, and socially he's pretty connected with you, and you do think, okay, he is kind of a candidate for me to push a little bit. And again, this would be after several sessions that you kind of know where he's functioning, and he already likes you, and he already wants to be with you, and he already wants to dig through your bag and see what kind of cool thing you brought today for him to play with. These are the rules that I use for withholding. And again, this is in the first DVD, Teach Me to Talk. And I never ever withhold for something that, unless I know a kid really wants it. Because what good is it for you to say, you know, work really hard to tell me this thing or say this word or do this sign if he could care less? I mean, you've totally lost him. So you have to make sure that it's something that he is willing to work for. And so you have to, if I were a really academic person, I would say you have to establish appropriate motivators or, you know, spend some time with stimulus selection or something like that. And bottom line, I think you just have to find some really things that you know that he's going to like based on your knowledge of children, like most two-year-old boys like Thomas the Train, or most toddlers are going to enjoy Bubbles. You use that general knowledge, and then you use those specific knowledge that you've gained through a session or two that you pretty much, again, know what he likes. So you withhold for only words that you know, or for things that you know that he wants. Secondly, you don't really use withholding in the strictest sense of the word unless you know a kid can probably say the word already. So unless you've heard him imitate the word, or unless you think, okay, he has these sounds in his repertoire, he already has a really similar word that he can say, or gosh, I've heard him imitate this word, you know, the last three times I've been here, you wouldn't really withhold per se for something that you don't have, a 90% shot of knowing that you're going to hear. Otherwise, it's unrealistic. I mean, that would be like somebody saying to me, you better tell me the Russian word for stop, or I'm going to hold this gun to your head. You know, I think, oh, I want to say it, but I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. And so you have to make sure that the kid has enough, you have enough information about him to think that he is probably going to be able to say it before you start withholding and making that kind of pressure.
Do you start with, like, let's say you've got your kiddo and he's, you know, receptively okay and, like you said, socially connected, and so he's really ready to start talking, and, mm-hmm. you know, let's say he knows some signs. So would you start with,
yes.
Tell me? You know, tell me with the sign for the item.
I would start with the signs. Mm-hmm. And
so
I would
I've
get
done that,
really
and I feel
used
like
to
I,
performing.
I feel like I can't get the bridge now then to talking, like, because they'll get so good at doing that more. They'll just do
but
more
you,
for everything for like a million.
Okay, and see, and I don't let a kid do more for everything more than a session or two. Boy, then I am bumping it up. And he has to sign go, or he has to sign car if we're playing with cars. I don't just stick with more. I mean, more is a great introductory sign, and I do love it because it's general and because it works for everything. But I only let that work for everything for a week or two before we are bumping it on up and targeting more specific signs. And even if he's not ready to talk yet, you can still teach him lots and lots and lots of new things using different signs rather than just relying on that one trick. you know, and again, I do love it because it's all purpose, and I'm glad that kids are able to use that at home. But I don't, if a kid is really proficient with more, I mean, we're doing that a week or two, and then, boy, we are moving on and adding several new signs every single session so that a kid really might have 30 or 40 signs before I'm ever going to hear a word attempt. So that's one thing you can do is really increase the number of signs that you're using. Are you better with that? I mean, do you move them on up or you let them just kind of do more for a long time?
Well, that's where I'm just totally stuck because I'm such a pushover. Like, they do something. I just want to give it right to them. And I'm trying to hold myself back and, like, push them to the next level. And then that's where I get all sort of confused, like, while I'm doing it. Like, should I accept this? He said more. You know, should I shape his little hands to make that ball sign? That's a hard one. Could he do that?
Yeah.
You know.
Carrie, I'll say I too have many kids now in the past and I'm sure in the future who get the more. They get that. They want to use it for everything. Parents tend to go with that, you know, not infrequently. I guess because I'm a student of the Laura Mize approach, I don't let it fly either. And even though kids will try that, and I can't say I blame them. It's like sometimes they look at you like, well, you let it work the last time, you know, like what's up with that? And I think the answer is as long as you are continuing to use things that they really enjoy and you're really up and animated and playful, generally it's not, I remember years ago feeling like, okay, I got the more, what do I do from here? I think it's really critical that you don't allow that for, like Laura said, more than maybe a session or two in the beginning. You're thrilled to get more, and that's like, woohoo, let's celebrate it. But then there are a lot of kids that, and, you know, so many of the kids we see, not only do they have receptive and or almost all expressive and many receptive language, they also frequently have motor planning problems, they have sensory problems, they have cognitive issues, and so they're not necessarily great at doing the signs. And who, you know, doesn't understand why if they can continue to use more, that's what they're going to do because it's a challenge. And, you know, even though we're keeping it as fun as possible, it's easy for them to kind of get stuck there if we allow it. And so I don't personally have a big problem with that, but I think once you do it a time or two and you see, well, by gum, he did get, you know, the next sign, please, or done, or go, or I usually in the beginning use fairly general, like those signs, more, please, eat, all done, go. I wouldn't necessarily, ball I have found is a really hard sign for kids to do motor planning wise.
Yeah,
and
I don't use ball very much. I mean, it would be kind of a second or third tier sign that I would teach. The other thing, the other reason I don't really like the sign for ball is it looks a lot like more. And so
yeah.
I didn't really know that the kid has done it. So after more, I'm just like Kate, I move on to a sign like please. And, you know, the sign for please is rubbing your chest with your open palm. That's generally a pretty easy one to get. And, again, it works
right.
as well as more. I do like Kate, too, with eat. That's a good one. I almost always do snacks at the beginning with the kid. So that's an easy one for a lot of kids to imitate. Just a finger or some kind of hand movement to the mouth is what you're taking for eat. And, again, I like to start out with signs that look completely different. So even if a kid is approximating the sign, you can recognize the difference between patting, you know, rubbing your chest for please versus your hands to midline for more versus your hand on your mouth for eat. So I would move on with some of those. On the website, Carrie, in the sign language section, there's an article that outlines kind of the hierarchy for teaching signs and the order for teaching signs. So you can take a look at what other ones, because it sounds like you might have a kind of struggle to think what sign is going to be easy enough to do but still kind of work for lots of different things and what signs are going to be appropriate to kind of move to next. So the ones that I use all the time and that I have good success with are kind of listed. And again, you're not going to want to go in order per se, okay, you know, I have to teach it in this particular order. It's just to give you a general idea of how you could use those, and it keeps you from getting stuck at just using more for everything.
Right. So with kind of like good, ball, I've said to many parents, I wish it weren't such a hard sign. And I've tried to think of it as something, because I'm certainly not above modifying a sign if I figured out something, or Laura has, or some other therapist. I am totally comfortable with modifying how a child does a sign or how I model a sign. But ball is like, it's just really hard for little kids to do that. Like Laura said, a lot of times it looks like more anyway. Occasionally I'll get a good signer, and by that I mean, it's not that challenging for them motor planning-wise or fine motor skill to do a variety of signs, and then I would use it. More often than not with ball, you can get them saying ball before you can get them signing ball.
Yeah, that's what I think, too.
I would say go to simpler signs, and by that I mean more general signs and easier signs for kids to do. Eat, please. I do all done early because kids like that power. They like being able to tell you they're all done, and I respect that, so that's one I do real early. Those are kind of my go-to ones, unless mom says, he absolutely loves something, you know. Sometimes I'll do milk pretty early on. Sometimes I'll do, let me think what other ones.
I do cracker and cookie with snacks.
Yeah.
I introduce those pretty early. I never really introduce cookie until we've got some other signs going, so that I'll think, okay, he's got some fine motor differentiation, so cookie's not going to look exactly like more. You know, I might try to introduce cracker or even fish before then, so that there's, again, kind of a really obvious motor difference. If a kid, I really look at their toys to see what they like. Choo-choo is a big one for little boys, and for choo-choo, I, you know, do like I'm pulling the whistle in the air. That's one that I do pretty early, pretty frequently.
Early. And that's it. Kids really love that one and do it pretty easily, too. So that's usually a pretty early one.
But there's a list on the website of what signs that you could, you know, that you could bump it up to. And that's what I would do for kids who are not ready to talk yet. I would really work on increasing the number of signs that they know and do, so that you can get some different kinds of requests with those. And so, you can move them along that way. And so that you do have kind of something to fall back on, like, okay, we've gotten more. What else am I going to do for the next 55 minutes that I'm here? teach a bigger variety of signs. And I don't quit teaching signs until a kid talks pretty well. So I make sure that I know enough signs so that I'm going to be able to teach a whole lot of words. I have some, some kids that are signing, have my little Emma Kate right now that has Down syndrome that's just turning 3, she knows like 60, 70 signs. And so, you could technically keep building a kid's vocabulary that way and challenging them that way until they're really ready to learn how to talk. And it does give you that fallback position for when you're withholding for word attempts. You can always accept the sign so that they don't get too frustrated and then try to walk away from you or, start to have a tantrum or a meltdown or something. You want to be sure that you've got another go-to default that you can have them do where they're still participating with you and they're still wanting what you have and you're still keeping it at a level that they could be successful, but you need to have more than one sign to be able to fall back on there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's something that I need to know more signs, because I'm not fluently being able to come up with them quickly when I'm in that situation. But did you say
Let me tell you this really quickly.
Okay.
On the website in the sign language category, there's also an article that lists all those early signs, and you can click on the link, and it will take you to another website where there's a picture of a person performing the sign. So you can teach yourself a lot of signs on the website there and learn them. And I would just, you know, take that first little list of signs and, or, you know, match whatever your favorite go-to toys are and see if they're on that list and learn those signs first. Because in this next week, you can teach lots of your kids, you know, five new signs, and then next weekend, learn five more. And the next week, teach five more signs to lots of the kids on your caseload and really kind of learn as your kids do. And that's perfectly fine. You didn't have to know signs before because you worked with older kids and they're, for the most part, they were all talking. So this is just a new skill set that you'll have to incorporate.
But, Carrie, do refer to Laura's list because those are the words that are tried and true, tested in the trenches, you know, and I would say, well, yeah, you need to learn some, but target those that have already been tested by Laura, really, because she, you know, she's done the time, the work to figure out what works, what's practical, what's functional, what can kids do easily. And I wouldn't try and reinvent that wheel. I would just really, just stick with which one she introduces first. I mean, yeah, you're going to alter them a bit based on the child, based on whatever, but really I have found that, yeah, you can try other things, but these are really what work and these are what make the most sense, not only for kids, how they are developmentally, but as far as what they can do with their motor skills, but, you know, she's kind of done the work for you on that. So I would say just look at the list and learn those signs if you don't know them. And you may know them. You know, you may know most of them. But rather than, you know, learning all the different, because most kids really are, the vast majority of the kids that I work with, and Laura, I know you too, particularly with the lack of some other diagnosis, that, you know, they are going to be verbal, and a lot of times they really are talking before you might get to a sign like helicopter,
right,
or
right.
You know, you don't really need to know that because they're going to be at least approximating that word before you're going to teach that sign. So I would really stick with her list and go, this works for her, I'm going to stick with these signs and go with that.
And on the first words list, they're just—it's just about 25 different ones. It's not like there's 75 different signs there or anything. It's just like 25 different ones that are, again, like Kate said, easy to do, targeted based on vocabulary of, you know, early vocabulary words. What's going to be most appealing to most children? So again, the work's already done for you there. Did you have a question before I interrupted you to tell you about the signs language article there?
Well, I just think I remember you saying, maybe in another podcast or maybe I read it, that for go, you're rolling your hands like the wheels on the bus. Is that right, or is that another word?
Yes. Nope,
that's
I
what
do
you
that.
Use.
That's how I do go. Mm-hmm. And okay. Kate actually is who got me signing go that way, because I was doing it with the ASL version with your index fingers pointing out, and a lot of kids couldn't do it. And Kate told me a long time ago, oh, I just roll my hands like wheels on the bus go round and round. And I thought, oh, what, that's brilliant. I'm doing that. And it is an early
and was
one.
Was I even smart enough to think of it? No. I learned it from another really good speech language pathologist many years ago. So, you know, like I said, if you know that what Laura does works, then go with it. That's what I do with that sign, and so many more kids will sign it. I actually go with exactly what she did. This was a good friend of mine, Melanie, who moved on to a different part of the country. But I usually do ready with my thumbs up set with index fingers pointed out, and then I roll my hands like go. I mean, I roll my hands like wheels on the bus. And a lot of little boys in particular end up doing that, kind of like a little punching thing. And it's really cute, funny. And they seem to like it, you know, because I think most little boys have pretended to fight at some point in their little lives. And they like that. They're doing a little punching thing. So many boys, once they see that, you know, their eyes light up and they're like, ooh, I can do that. So that's the way I do it. But, yep. It'll work. And as far as Carrie, I feel your hesitation or discomfort with, oh gosh, you know, they want to sign go, and what do I, you know, I want to bump them up, but I don't quite know. And I'd say, as long as you really, really keep it playful, what I do in that circumstance a lot of times is say, I didn't say more. I said go, and then I'm going to model, you know, ready, set, go. Or I didn't say, I said cookie. I said please, you know, and I'm going to make kind of a joke out of it, you know, because
right.
it's not, you're not, you don't want them, you know, in no way do you want them to feel like they're being told they did it wrong or they did, you know,
mm-mm.
they're not going to get it. Or, you know, if you're really, really over the top animated and playful with it, most kids, even really very delayed kids, seem to be very responsive to that. And so instead of getting a meltdown or some behavioral outburst, you kind of get a twinkle from them that says, gee, you're a lot of fun, I get you. And they may not automatically do it, but I certainly do take their hands and then have them, you know, sign please or have them sign eat or have them sign cookie or whatever it is I'm targeting. And Laura and I have over the years shared a lot of kids, and one comes to mind early on, and I think he had more, maybe one other side. And he was a toughie as far as, you know, we both said, okay, we're digging in our heels. We are going to build this kid's sign repertoire and ultimately his verbal repertoire, and it works. But we had to kind of, you know, we are not, I should say I am not. Sometimes I have to consciously say, no, I'm pushing you beyond that. You know what I mean? And I kind of give myself a little pep talk as I go in thinking, we've had these for a little while, whether it's one sign or five signs or 10 signs or whatever, and I'm going to push you beyond that today. And normally, really the vast majority of the time, kids take to that pretty well. Sometimes it's just a matter of you kind of steeling yourself for, you know, nope, we're moving on, because it is easy for kids to get really comfortable with what they know. And, you know, in their defense, at one point we really celebrated they did more and eat mine, but now, you know, it's time to build on that. So
do you think that when I was watching the apraxia phonological disorders video that, you know, and watching some of these techniques that and the kids that you had on there, and then also at the same time I'm kind of trying to listen to some of the old podcasts when I drive around because I do a lot of driving. So I'm getting, like, different pieces of, like, the philosophy as I go around. And so I think maybe do I have an unrealistic idea? Like, I think there was one conversation you were having, like, oh, if I had gone in and worked with that kid, I would have gotten 20 words out of his mouth. And I was like, whoa, I'm really a failure.
It just depends on the kid.
Because I'm not
going
to get even one.
It just depends on the kid. It really depends on the kid.
It's kids where it might take 6 weeks or it might take,
yeah,
you might take months.
Months.
Like maybe I'm like,
yeah,
looking at it like I should be able to do this right bang. Like I come in and then they're sitting there and they love me and they're saying ball and, you know, they're signing and, you know, but maybe I should be thinking more. For some kids it's going to be a longer process.
Exactly. Exactly. And every kid on the apraxia video and every kid on every DVD that we've done has been an established client of mine, except for maybe two. And Colin, that's on the apraxia DVD, I was a replacement therapist for him, and he had had another therapist for about a year. He's a little boy with really dark hair. I don't know if you remember him on the apraxia DVD or not. But he was so ready kind of to be pushed to the next level because he had had another therapist that really just kind of played with him and didn't do very much of anything. So he was really ready developmentally for me to push him along. If I had just started with him that year before, it might have taken me 3 or 4 months to get him to the spot where he was really ready to verbally imitate. That, you know, none of those sessions were filmed on the first day I saw a kid. They had to be really going pretty well before, even if they weren't great talkers yet, I had to have worked with them long enough to know what I was going to be able to get from them on that day. So that might be a little, that might alter your perception a little bit. The other thing I'm going to do, Carrie, is I'm going to send you a copy of Teach Me to Talk to thank you for being on the podcast today. And I think if you watched that one first and then watched the apraxia video, it would have made a little more sense, because the Teach Me to Talk Again outlines just kind of the basic beginning philosophy, which is where you're going to start kids, and then after you've seen them a while is when you bump it up to the more advanced, pleasantly pushy stuff that you do, that I did in the apraxia DVD.
Thank you.
Does that make sense to you? You're welcome. But I do want you to look at that one first, because I think that'll answer some of your questions. The rules for withholding are on the Teach Me to Talk DVD too. And let me just, we're almost out of time, but I want to run through those real quickly. The second part of withholding, again, we talked about you're going to withhold really for words or signs that you know a kid has a great shot at being able to do. You're only going to prompt it 3 to 5 times. You're not going to tell a kid, you know, 32 times, tell me, tell me, tell me. You're going to just stick to that 3 to 5 time range there before you give them the item anyway. And it really doesn't matter if they sign it or say it, they're still going to get the item. I mean, I never withhold and don't eventually give it to them in that 3 to 5 time window. If they're crying on time two, and if I see that it's about to start on time one, I give it to them way before they even start crying. Because you don't want to lose a kid, because then I feel like, gosh, that's going to take him 15 minutes to recover. And I'm not staying here all day. I'm just here 1 hour, so that you really kind of judge how hard and how long you can kind of push a kid, so that you're using withholding only within the boundaries of what you know a kid can do. And when I'm pushing a kid that hard on the apraxia DVD, it's because I know that particular kid's going to be able to take it. I don't think there's anybody on the DVD that's flailing themselves backwards and crying and, you know, carrying on, because I would stop way before that. And even if it did happen, I wouldn't show it. I wouldn't have put it in the DVD. So you do have to kind of get that, you know, balance that, engage a kid's responses so that you're not pushing them over the edge. And I think in one of your first emails that you sent me, it was so cute how you said, you know, how do you balance using the material that you're using and still being fun and still kind of pushing them to do it, and then you look over and the kid's about to have a tantrum and mom's looking at you like, you know, do you really know what you're doing? Or, you know, she's kind of questioning you. And all of that, again, I think just takes time to kind of come into your own with using a different approach than maybe you've done before. You know, it's just going to take you some practice so that you're comfortable with it and you feel like you can manage all of those parameters without it completely, you know, pushing the kid over the edge.
And I think, too, I need to maybe also, one of the things I'm feeling is pressure that I need to be of value to this family, like, bang, like, right off the bat. Because
yeah, and that's why I think using really high energy and going in and being really playful and really getting those signs moving in the first few weeks will demonstrate that. And will make a family feel like confident about your skills and excited that you're coming for speech and excited that their kid is, oh, he's gonna do so great today, and she's so smart, she's teaching him all these things we didn't even know that he could sign. They build that confidence because of how you portray that and how you walk in and kind of you know, immediately get going with that stuff. And I think some therapists, again, because of territorial issues, maybe are not as confident. You know, I'm going to go into this house and kind of take over here, and I'm not going to let this kid dig through my bag, and he may be a little bit mad at me when I'm saying, oh, no, we've got to do this first, or we've got to clean this up before we move on to something else. And, you know, you have to just kind of take control of the session that way, and I understand that pressure of, you know, feeling like I've got to get in there and prove my worth. And I think because of that is why I think this approach works better rather than a more laid back, take it as the kid wants to take it, or watch him and narrate. That's why I think this is a better approach. It's more bang for your buck, as you said.
Carrie, let me say this.
one of the reasons that Laura has become the go-to, not so much anymore because she's so busy with all of her other endeavors with the speaking and writing and everything, but, I mean, not because she's not just as much in demand, but she's broadening her horizons professionally. Anyway, you know, I've been on teams when Laura was a replacement therapist, and certainly heard of lots of situations where she came in after another therapist had been there 6 months or a year, or, and, you know, it's very common for Laura to be able to get and be able to get way more from a child in 1 hour than the therapist she's replacing was able to get in multiple sessions, maybe ever. And here she is just hitting the ground running. And I think that's because it's so much more playful. It's so much more animated and fun, genuinely fun for the kid. And, I mean, if you think about it, that, I think it's just kind of human nature. If you're really happy and having fun, a little bit of, I hate to call it discomfort, but a little bit of the stress that we may be causing because we're saying you have to sign it, you have to say it. Come on. You know, we're pushing them, but we're at the same time getting them in the right place emotionally to be able to do it. Laura likes to tease me because I go on one of my mantras, repeated. You've probably heard it as you were driving someplace. It's about that heightened level of arousal. They have to be really mad, really scared, or really excited. And, again, that's just adrenaline flowing, and that's when we do perform our best, whether we're two or we're, well, shall I say much older, you know, that's when just we can do those things that are more challenging with less obvious effort. So, you know, it really, really, really makes it easier for them. And I think kids, I don't know if they understand that exactly, but they do understand that fun one is here. And, you know, yeah, there may be a few minutes where she's not giving me exactly what I want, or I have to do some kind of perform some task or try and do something that's difficult for me, whether it be the word or the sign or both. But the payoff is huge, and kids get that. You know, they, whether they understand it or not, it works for them. So you're able to push them more. You're able to withhold more. You're able to demand more than if you take a real passive approach, because it's so much harder for them if they're flat. And so many of the kids that I see, and I suspect that you see, are kind of flat kids. They're kind of low energy, low arousal. Not much really gets them going. And it's either that extreme or the other extreme, the kids who are really, really, really pretty busy and they're zooming all over the room. And how in the world are you going to hold that kid's attention with a low arousal approach yourself? I mean, they're going to look at you like, boy, are you boring? I would much rather run around this room. And probably that's what they would do unless you're holding their attention somehow. So I guess I'm just saying, I think if you'll work on your own discomfort with it, you'll see, wow, I really do get much better results. You know, it really does work. So...
Oh, yeah, and I can see that from watching it, and that's why I'm so interested in learning more.
Right.
And I'm on board. I'm definitely not. It's definitely good, practical information that it definitely has been more helpful to me than anything else that I've purchased or read or bought, you know,
right,
as I've been getting into working with very small children, because it's just very... You know, it's real problems and real solutions to those problems that I feel like you
right.
guys are offering.
And we've all
real
had
talk,
the same,
not just a
the
lot
same.
Of therapeutic mumbo jumbo.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
It's a, what do I really do?
Like,
when
what
I'm
do I really do with
more?
This kid?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, most approaches are very theoretical and really not very practical. They don't really give you the how-tos.
Like, how what do I do
theory?
Once I'm in that house with that kid? And
right.
I do think that for me, I just need to put the pieces together, and then I need
right.
to figure
right.
out how can I do it being myself, being who I am.
Right.
You know, I can't
right.
be Laura, so I have to do it I have to be Carrie, so I can still be, you know, still have the same basic approach, but that I have to figure that out for myself. So
right. You are just going to have to figure it out for yourself, and it does take some practice and some sessions where Kate said you might not be as comfortable because it's new, and I'm never comfortable when I'm learning something new. I mean, never, ever, ever, whether I'm talking about when I was a little girl or a teenager or even as an adult, because it just, it challenges us to kind of move beyond what we've already done. And so, but you can do it with your own personality and with your own little spin on that. I've gotten a lot, after the conferences that I do, almost every conference, at least one person, and it's usually more than that, will write on the evaluation form, or they will email me in the weeks later, or I'll see them at something, like they've come to a conference and I might have seen them at the Kentucky Speech and Hearing Association thing, and they'll say, okay, when I just decided that I was going to be really fun and go in and be woohoo and raise my own energy level, that's what changed for me more than anything. Parents like me better. Kids like me better. I'm getting more words. I'm getting more results. You know, that one little attitude shift with I'm going to bump it up a little bit, and who knows whether bump it up for somebody is bumping it up, you know, one level or 10 levels. You know, everybody has to kind of decide on their own, but just that one increase in energy and affect seems to make a bigger difference from, you know, more than just a handful of people have told me that. And I think that's what Kate said, would say to me at the very beginning. That's what people kind of vocalize in the conferences, like, oh, I told you about Kate, that girl that in Louisiana, Miss Laura, I'm going to have to step up my game. You know, that just decision, which, you know, that's your whole process here, Carrie, which you're thinking, how can I do this differently? What can I do differently? That one change is what seems to make the difference. So, again, you're going to have to do it in your own time and your own way, but that seems to be the key indicator, just that bump up in affect.
And, you know, Carrie, I would say, as you said, you gotta do it with what you're comfortable with. It, you know, suits your personality. But I remember years ago, kind of being a developmental therapist and thinking I was okay. And then one time I shared a session with Laura many years ago, and I think I was pretty playful and I was pretty animated. But after one session with her, I thought, okay, maybe I'm not quite as animated as I need to be, not quite as playful as I need to be. And I don't think on my best day I'm the natural that Laura is. Sometimes I'm having to force it a little bit. I will say this, once you do it some, it becomes so much easier, and it's so rewarding, because you will see with the same kids that you've been seeing. Sometimes I have to tell myself during a session, ratchet it up, ratchet it up. I'm not up enough. I've got to zip it up because I'm losing him, or he's not really very interested, or he's not performing as well as he has in the past. And so you can, it can become, even though you're going to put your spin on it and you're going to do what you're comfortable with, it can become pretty automatic. And you'll see once you really start to implement it that, you know, you almost feel like you have to. And it can become not only automatic, but just so much easier. You know, you can turn it on, and it's not nearly as taxing after you've done it a while. In the beginning, you know, I didn't see too many kids, and I thought I was exhausted, because it's, when you're really having to think as you're doing it, it is pretty exhausting to do it. But then when it becomes more automatic, it's just like anything else, and you think, that wasn't so bad. You know, I mean, once you get comfortable with it, you're going to be able to get there very quickly, and you won't feel like you've run a marathon after an hour with a kid. In the beginning, it's hard. It's pretty demanding on the therapist, really, especially if you've been a more passive kind of therapist.
Laid-back personality.
Yeah, more of a laid-back. Then you got to go in there, woo-hoo-hoo, you know. Really?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much... Yeah, that's a stretch for me. Really,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just people are always saying, oh, you are so calm. So, I really need to, that's a 10 for me, like, in terms of a, change in how I'm going to approach it. But I definitely am going to try, and I appreciate all your encouragement.
It really
you can do it.
Like I said, I'm not going to have a hyper side to me, but as far as my natural tendencies in engaging and playing with children, I don't think it's nearly as natural for me as it is for Laura. But I've learned a lot of it, and you really can learn it. You know, even if it's going to be a little different in your implementation, you can still just take the basic principles of I've got to be up. If I want him to stay focused and stay with me and perform to the very best of his ability, he's got to be up. And if he's got to be up, you've got to be up.
The other thing I want to address, though, is it's not a 180 from being nurturing and sweet to children. And I hope you didn't get the impression from the Apraxia DVD that I don't adore kids and love them and love on them. Yeah. And I don't look at it like, I feel like if I can teach you how to do this, then you are going to be on your way. You know, you're going to be better prepared for preschool and for, first grade and for all those things. And if I can just bump it up and make it easier for you to achieve these things now at 2, even with a little more increased effort on my part, for lack of a better word, why wouldn't I want to go ahead and kind of move it in that direction? And, again, I'm not saying that everybody has to do it exactly the same way. I just think, because of the kids that we get that are delayed, and usually they have some sensory system differences too, this is one really good, not guaranteed, but more likely than any other way to get them ready to imitate words so that they can learn how to talk. So I'm going to send you, though, Teach Me to Talk, because I think that you might have missed some of that kind of basic foundational stuff first. And if you'll see that stuff, it might make it a little easier to kind of put all the pieces in place. So you'll have to call us back in a few weeks after you watch it and after you kind of try your hand at some of this stuff and give us a little report card on Carrie and on how you're doing and help us and let us help you problem solve through through some of that stuff. But we so appreciate you calling tonight, and thanks so much for sharing that and asking questions. Lots of therapists don't even want to do that because they just kind of feel like, I'm just going to kind of do what I'm doing, and it has to be good enough because I got my degree, so it must be good enough. So I really admire and applaud any therapist who's out there looking for new ideas and a different way of doing things. So thank you so much for calling and sharing that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate all the information. I really do.
Thank you. Good luck. It'll
thank
come.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay, bye.
Okay,
bye.
Bye, Carrie. You still there, Kate?
Yeah.
I think we might have worn her out. Just us talking to her.
I think so.
I love that she's trying so hard to put all these things together and make it all make sense. I wish she could come to a conference too, because I think that would help things make a lot more sense too. And I always just kind of think, how analytical I am. What could I have said differently in that DVD to make her understand it? What could I have said on another podcast to make it come together? What could I have written on the website to pull it together? And I think the answer is you just have to keep looking and watching and listening to kind of answer some of those questions. And the most important thing is just to put it into practice rather than kind of analyzing it so much. You know what I mean?
Right. I think also the thing about if she'd seen Teach Me to Talk first.
Yeah.
She went right into the Apraxia one, which is higher level and great, but
it's
kind of a thing.
It's pushier. It's definitely pushier. But again, those kids on the Apraxia DVD, that's what they needed to talk. Or else I still think my little Ainsley on there would still be nonverbal because she just really needed that that push and that help to get over the hump.
Those are the kids.
So, yeah.
Some of my kids, I'd say I push them all kind of from the beginning, but I don't push them on the same things. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yes, yes, and that's a great way to put it. And you are kind of pushy, but for some kids, the first kind of pushy would be, you are going to play with me. And again,
right.
Not in a do-it-or-else way, but in a real fun, energetic,
right.
Nurturing. You know,
yeah.
Again, I'm kind of thinking, oh, I don't want her to think that I don't nurture kids, because I do. So,
you know what I think she really meant? This is just my read on it. I think she really meant you don't give them everything they want. That's not nurturing.
Well,
I think in her mind, because if you make them sign something, or you don't let them get to the bag when they want to, or that's not nurturing. I think in her, that's just my read on her personality and what she had to say. I think she
mm-hmm.
thinks, oh, you're being cruel. They want it in the bag and you didn't let them. You
yeah.
know, and if you're really a Hannon person and you're really,
really,
right. really passive, and to me, it's like, no, you know, whether they're 12 months developmentally or chronologically, you know, it's okay for kids to know there are some expectations and some demands on them as long as they're reasonable. I mean, you,
right.
you know, you're not, you know, and that's reasonable.
Yeah.
You got to know what reasonable is, but if it's reasonable, and I think kids really respond to that pretty well.
Because I think
yeah.
on some level they think, she knows I can do this. She believes in me.
Right.
She has faith in me. She, you know, she is thinking about, you know, and again, that would not be anything that could be a conscious decision for a kid at a 12-month or a 24-month developmental
right.
level.
But I think they kind of get it, too.
Right.
There is a reward, there is a payoff,
right.
and it's worth it to me. And pretty
right.
quickly, even pretty darn delayed kids get, okay, I'm gonna withstand this moment of discomfort because the payoff is there.
But that's how you teach them intentionality, and that's how you teach them, I've got to do something to get something. And that's why,
right.
that's the only reason any of us learn how to communicate. That's the only reason any of us learn how to talk, is because we figure out, okay, this is a much more efficient way than me laying down on the floor screaming and crying. If I just say it, if I just sign it, my mama knows exactly what I need, and I get it, and we move on. But for
right.
some kids, they don't get there unless you make them uncomfortable for just a smidgen of a minute. Or, you know, just, again, and this approach is so different from what some of their parents have used, that it does sometimes work in the very first week.
Yeah.
Some kids it does
uh-huh.
take weeks and months. And I certainly don't want to leave anybody with the impression that, you know, with any single kid you can go in on the first day and get 20 new words. That is never, ever anything that I've ever wanted to convey. And especially the point about receptive language. Until they are ready to talk developmentally, until they have the prerequisite social skills and receptive language skills, it is completely unrealistic. But like you said, you're pushing them on different things. It may be pushing them to, you know, to participate in Row Row Your Boat, a social game. It might be pushing them to follow some commands. You know, like we were saying earlier, you know, push it, open it, give it to me. You know, some of those really basic commands. That might be kind of what you're pushing them, for lack of a better word,
right.
on at the beginning. But you meet them where they are so that you can get them to that talking point. But not every kid is ready to talk on the first day of speech therapy. And that might be a point that her program doesn't address, and she might not be getting enough developmental information, and she might be like a lot of speech therapists who don't think about those foundational skills and that hierarchy. And that's what the whole conference is about. And you know, we are not going to do the conference every week on the show, but there really are lots and lots and lots of things that have to happen before a kid is ready to talk. And if you're not aware of those, and if you go in right from the first day pushing for that expressive response, no wonder you feel like you're spinning your wheels, you know, if a kid's not ready. So, anybody listening?
I'm not. Are we still being recorded?
Yes.
Oh, well, then I'm glad I clarified that. Yeah.
I am too.
When she brought up about she was beginning to suspect that not all the kids, it really
right.
was just an expressive issue, I thought,
right.
yeah, that's really, and that is what we hear. That's the common description.
Right.
Most parents believes that it's just that he can't say it. He knows it. He knows it.
Right.
And to me, like I said, on the show, which I guess still is the show, that...
It is still the show.
It is
still
the
show. People can hear this, Kate, so.
I know. I'm just saying what I said already. A lot of times that's really not the case. There's a lot
right.
of missing pieces there.
Right.
And that can
right.
be one of the most difficult things to share with the parent and one
right.
of the most difficult things to get them to understand or accept, really. And sometimes
right.
I'm successful, sometimes I'm not. But it's something I feel like is very important for me to know and to address so that...
Exactly.
If he really doesn't understand what he's supposed to understand, you're really setting the bar unrealistically high to go for the words, go for the words, go for the words, when the words are really not particularly meaningful to him.
Exactly. You've got to cover your bases, and you've got to have that good foundation in place before our kid's ready to talk. So, and I think when she watches Teach Me to Talk, that some of that will fall into place for her, just kind of, and you know, her experience too, it's like she's got a whole different job now. She went
right.
from school-age kids to babies. They, you know, it really shouldn't even be called the same kind of therapy or a therapist. And thank goodness that speech-language pathologists have that much flexibility, and we have all these great options in our careers, but it is a totally different job. And so many people make the switch from one population to another without thinking that they need to get a different skill set. And for babies, you got to have a whole different knowledge base and strategy base than you do with working with school-age children. I would flounder in working with school-age children because that's not what I do. That's not what I love. That's not my area. So you have to really take the time, like Carrie's doing, to increase your skills, get some new tricks, and make sure that what you're doing is appropriate. I love that she was so honest to call, and I meant that, because a lot of therapists don't ever get there, do they? They just
no.
stay mediocre forever. So I'm really... proud of her for calling. That was great. All right. We have probably just recorded the longest show ever in the history.
Oh, my.
To talk with Laura and Kate. But, oh, well, that's okay. It was a good one. Thanks so much, Kate. And next week we will be back. I want us to do what we started on the week before. We didn't have a show last week because of all the crazy basketball. But remember, we were talking about a word list and how we talk about our next targets with your little girl
yeah.
that you saw?
Yeah.
I want to do
oh,
that
yeah.
next. I'm going to start the show with that next week. So we'll have to talk about how those things worked and how she's doing, and kind of taking your word list that you sent me and then kind of walking through what's that next process. How do you move a kid from kind of a core little set of words to expand their vocabulary? Because I think that'll be a great show.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Talk
okay.
to you later.
Have a good
Thanks.
Night. Bye.
Bye.